Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
When Marilyn Monroe was found dead in August 1962, it shocked an adoring public. The sudden loss of Hollywood's most glamorous star was front page news, of course. How did she die? Well, officially a suicide, but many theories continue to circulate. Now, just 3 days before that, just 10 minutes up the road, a former FBI spy turned Hollywood private investigator by the name of A.B. Leckie had died in mysterious circumstances, but his death went mostly unnoticed, except, of course, for his family. Well, his grandson is Australian-based international human rights lawyer Scott Leckie, and Scott spent more than a decade researching A.B. Leckie's life and death. He thinks there might be a connection between the two deaths. And after accessing hundreds of FBI records on his grandfather, Scott's just written a book about his grandfather. It's called Shrewd Little Spy. Hey, Scott, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much. It's actually called Shrewd Little Sleuth.
Sleuth.
Sleuth, the word of the era. It's a direct quote from newspapers.
Yeah. All right, shrewd little sleuth. Now, this was your father's father, your grandfather. Had your own father told you much about your grandfather growing up?
Well, no, almost nothing at all. And that's kind of the reason I decided to write the book, to try to get to know this unknown guy that died just 3 or 4 months before I was born. And the only thing that I knew about him was a hand-drawn sort of poster in cartoon fashion with J. Edgar Hoover looming above the sitting person who was my grandfather, with Hoover's hand on his shoulder with an air bubble saying, "Leckie is one of our most outstanding agents. It is men like he who have made the organization what it is today." And that's all I knew about him. And so my father spoke never about his father, remarkably, until I was about 30 and visiting Southern California on a rare visit. Having left the United States for good in 1985, and then out of the blue, my dad said, "My father died 30 years ago today, exactly." And then I asked the waiter to bring more wine, and out came the stories that eventually became the book.
Okay, so what did he tell you that day? What were the things that most caught your attention?
Well, I mean, it's so many different things. This guy lived a life where he was, you know, a key player in all of these historical epochs of the 20th century of the United States, from the 30s until the 60s when he died. And so, you know, he had this period of time when he, you know, he grew up in the South, deep South, in the state of Alabama in the United States, and finally got out of there when he was 18 and went to Southern California and worked his way through college and then became an FBI agent during the early years of the FBI in 1934. And then he was praised repeatedly by Hoover. You know, I discovered all these documents, internal memos and documents and private letters and things of that nature between Hoover and my granddad. Thanks in part to a Freedom of Information Act search, which I carried out about 20 years ago. And the FBI kindly sent me 533 documents, but they told me there were 623 documents. So they actively withheld 90. So there's something in those ones, which I haven't gotten my hands on just yet. Mm-hmm. But that was the first period. So he was a rising star in the FBI, rose very high up in the ranks very quickly. And then out of the blue was summarily forced to resign, essentially. And I have all these internal documents. Like, you can spot that, like, the step-by-step approach they used, you know, internally to try to find dirt on him to justify his
So this happened in 1939. So what it looks to you is, if he didn't actually do anything that they could fire him for, but they tried to find reasons to fire him.
Exactly. You know, the classic sort of institutional thing, you know, create a paper trail that causes disdain and then leads to somebody being forced out and then given the option to resign, which he did formally. But interestingly, you know, that, you know, people get fired, I guess, all the time, right? And intriguingly, however, he stayed in touch with Hoover for the next 23 years of his life until he died. So the guy that fired him, his great hero, who he looked up to, you know, almost like a godlike figure, Hoover was the state within the state, they used to call him, you know, the guy that kept secret files on hundreds and hundreds of Americans, including Marilyn Monroe, by the way, of course. And then out of the blue, just months after being praised in this poster, Hoover is quoted saying, "Mince no words, let Leckie have it," you know? So something happened.
What?
I have my ideas. but I, you know, I don't have any proof per se, but I think there were some tensions between them that might not have been professional in nature, shall we say.
Okay, so just expand more on that. I mean, there were letters between him and J. Edgar Hoover. So what kind of relationship did they have? And what do you think might, if you're reading between the lines, what are you finding there?
Well, you know, there's some, you know, very sort of groveling letters, of course, from my grandfather, you know, like trying to, you know, curry favor with him years later and inviting him to baseball games and offering him free tickets and to, like, you know, plays and things like that. And then Hoover declines, but then Hoover contacts him back and says things like, you know, in the 60s, even he said, he's very double entendre sort of letters, you know? So one letter says, "Of course, I remember that waitress at the LA Ambassador Hotel. I was so glad that, you know, you reminded me of her," right? So who knows what that actually means. But there were a lot of very personal notes between them. And unfortunately, there would have been many, many, many more. But when his when his father died, my father, who was a big time LA lawyer, went through my grandfather's files. 300 boxes of immaculately kept files, as he said. And there was so much sensitive material in there that he destroyed them all. So all I was left with was the Freedom of Information Act search, all books and materials written about the players in the story, and about, let's say, a meter's worth of papers that were left behind. But unfortunately, that gold mine of 300 boxes disappeared forevermore.
Scott Leckie is here. Scott's book is Shrewd Little Sleuth. It's a story about his grandfather, A.B. Leckie. And as we get through the story, you'll hear about the bit where he becomes a private investigator for Marilyn Monroe. So just on the firing from the FBI, am I right in thinking that you suspected that maybe he was fired because he knew too much? And if that's so, what do you have any idea what that might have been about?
I mean, a lot of it's just, you know, guesswork, really, at this stage. There's, you know, as it always is in these kind of things, and I'm not really at all a conspiracy guy whatsoever, but my presumption is that the relationship between my grandfather, ABL, Arthur Bernard Leckie, and Hoover was extremely close, and that Hoover's deputy, Clyde Tolson, who was J. Edgar Hoover's lifelong boyfriend, didn't like that. And there were some, you know, bad feelings between them. And then those manifested in, you know, internal memos from Tolson to Hoover, pointing out flaws in the character of ABL and, you know, things like he worked too much. That was one of the reasons for getting rid of him. He worked 5 hours and 45 minutes overtime every day for the Bureau. So, you know, totally dedicated to the cause of fighting crime and keeping America safe and all of that. But that's kind of my suspicion. And then doing more research and deeper research throughout his life, there's just a lot of material that points in that direction.
So Leckie went on to get involved in the McCarthy trials, you know, which were quite famous, sort of trying to root out potential communists, suspected communists in American society. What role did your grandfather play in that?
He was one of the lead investigators for Joseph McCarthy, the House on Un-American Activities in Hollywood, unfortunately. So he was trying to root out alleged communist activity in the motion picture industry. And he even took my father with him many times to surveil actors and film studio heads, plant bugs, do all of the things that spies did on behalf of Joseph McCarthy during one of the darkest and unfriendliest periods of 20th century America that ended up ruining the lives of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people who were suspected of being members of the Communist Party and forced to go to Washington and testify in front of the House on Un-American Activities because of it. And one of the famous stories of my granddad is that he got Robert Taylor, who was sort of a sex symbol of the time, you know, a George Clooney type character, to come to Washington and testify before the hearings and out, essentially, alleged communists that were supposedly running Hollywood, which is a sentiment that you still hear to this day, of course, right, by the current administration, that Hollywood is run by lefties and so on and so forth. So the process is not ended by any means, even though that House on Un-American Activities no longer exists, of course. And Hoover, of course, those who know American history, hated McCarthy, and McCarthy hated Hoover, and they tried to battle each other to see who could be more anti-communist than the other, you know, and that resulted in all sorts of, you know, political stories that came out later on.
Scott, after the McCarthy trials, your grandfather ended up putting those spy skills to use as a private investigator for Hollywood stars. So what kind of work did that involve?
Well, even before that, you know, it's worth mentioning that he was also in charge of security at the founding meeting of the United Nations in San Francisco in 1945, right after the war. And so, you know, using his spy skills, it's widely known that the United States delegation spied on all of the other 50 nation states who had delegations there at the UN charter meetings. So he was in charge of that. Then he did the House on Un-American Activities. And then I think he decided to slow down a bit, just retreat back to LA and become a private eye. So he essentially became, you know, a private eye to the stars. And there was, you know, Marlon Brando was one of them, and Robert Mitchum was one of them. And at the end of his life, of course, Marilyn Monroe was one of them.
So how did he then come to know Marilyn Monroe?
Well, the story that I know is that she contacted him. He didn't contact her, and she would have known through her circles that there was this private eye running around Hollywood that, you know, was a good private investigator for her fellow actors. And she asked him to investigate who it was or what it was that was terrorizing her, according to my dad's quotes. And so she knew that she was being spied upon, essentially, and she just didn't know exactly who was doing it. And so he snooped around, he sleuthed around for a few weeks and found out, and they met up on the 1st or 2nd of August 1962. On the 3rd of August he died. On the 5th of August she died, both in mysterious circumstances, you know, just 10-15 minutes drive apart.
So Scott, when LA. You say he found out, what did he find out?
Well, it's now known that she was being, you know, surveilled by at least six different entities, all of whom had different interests in hearing what she had to say. So the FBI was, of course, one of them, because they wanted to get dirt on her, ultimately on the Kennedy family, who was running the country at the time. It's widely known now that the president, John F. Kennedy, and his brother, the Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy, were having affairs with Marilyn Monroe at the same time. And she was also having affairs with a leading mafia figure also at the same time, and spending a lot of time at the beach house of Peter Lawford down in Santa Monica, where a lot of these dalliances went on. So that's all widely known. So Hoover, of course, knew about it. He wanted to use that as leverage against the Kennedys, who he loathed greatly. The mafia was allegedly involved in spying on her. Some say that the Cuban exiles were allegedly involved in spying on her because of Kennedy's failure to send in troops following the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, illegal invasion of, by the United States of Cuba, and a number of other entities. So he, being the spy that he was, and the investigator, clearly would have found this all out quite quickly and told her. And then that meant, of course, that once she knew who it was definitively, the people that were doing it also knew that he was the source behind telling her. So one theory is that if it's not true that she died of what her death certificate says, probable suicide, and she was in fact either induced to suicide or, you know, something more nefarious, then very easily the same fate could have befallen him. And his circumstances of death are extremely suspicious.
You know, right, tell us about those. How is he said to have died? What's on his death certificate?
Yeah, it was one of those things. So he was over at my parents' house in downtown LA, and they were having a great time, and he was jumping for joy that I was about to be born, and he was in great spirits, and no indication at all that he was going to, you know, pass away a day or two later. And essentially, he was found face down on the floor with the front door wide open, and with Marilyn Monroe's private phone number in his back pocket. So nobody really knew. My dad, you know, being the lawyer that he was, tried to do his own investigations, and he was not at all the kind of suspicious conspiracy type person. He suspected greatly that he was probably murdered, even though the death certificate, of course, didn't say anything of that nature. And then she died in these very, very controversial circumstances, just 36 hours later. And, you know, the doubts and suspicions surrounding her death went on for decades. I mean, they're still there to this day, but they were attempting to exhume her body even in the 1980s, you know, 25 years later, just to prove, you know, that it wasn't actually some sort of murder. So there's still all these open questions and doubts, and there will probably never be definitive answers given, but the simple fact that, you know, he died when he did and she died when she did, you know, was more than enough to get me interested in trying to get to know my granddad and writing this book. And in doing so, I really got to know him almost better than I know my parents, you know, because you delve so deeply into the life of an unknown person who you've never met. Yeah.
And so, Scott, before we leave behind the Marilyn Monroe story, I'm just wondering, obviously you said your father had tried to figure out what might have happened, but couldn't. Do any names come up? Do any theories come up that you thought, well, maybe that would be it, but I can't prove it?
One of the theories is that, you know, this is real, not theory. He hung out. He had a big inclination to drink large amounts of alcohol on a regular basis. And I think this is part of the reason my dad never spoke about him. So he would end up very intoxicated at a bar called The Tail of the Cock in L.A. and La Cienega Boulevard. It's not there anymore, but it was a very famous place. And he was probably spouting his mouth off one night after a bottle of Early Times whiskey, which he was very fond of, and probably said a little bit too much. And that was heard by the wrong people. And then two and two got put together. And then they were sort of in the same sort of, a lot of actors and studio heads and stuff used to hang out there. They all kind of came together, and it became clear to people that should not have known that he knew everything. Mm. So that's, I think, you know, the likely nature of the story. And I hope, you know, a investigative journalist much better than me can spend more time delving into it, because I think there's a lot still out there to be discovered.
Scott Leckie is with us. His book about his grandfather, A.B. Leckie, is called Shrewd Little Sleuth. You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio with Suzanne Hill. We've got a couple of minutes left, Scott, but I want you to just tell me, you talk about feeling like you know him better than you know your own parents in some ways, but tell us about, apart from the job, what kind of person was he? You know, what else have you got to know about his nature and his character?
I think I discovered essentially that he was, like, for lack of a better term, a rascal. You know, he was a sort of boisterous, larger than life, jolly guy who was extremely dedicated and extremely hardworking, but had a great deal of frustration that I think led him to, unfortunately, drink too much and die at a relatively young age, because I think he was not only, you know, heavily affected by being ousted from the FBI and all of that, but there's, you know, at least a possibility that he was also, you know, closeted essentially and unable to publicly express his sexuality. And because of that, you know, had to do all sorts of things, as everyone who was gay at that time had to do, to hide who they really were. And that could have easily led him to drink too much and do all sorts of other things that led to, you know, an early demise. So I think that side of it is really quite sad. But remarkably, I now literally speak to him in dreams. Every so often, that's happened about 5 or 6 times, I will dream about him and we actually have conversations between ourselves. And every time I get to the kind of questions you're asking, you know, the real juicy ones, like, who did it? Or, you know, is it really true? Then I wake up, you know, but we have these long conversations face to face.
What do you talk about?
I hear his voice. It's sort of a mixture of my voice and my dad's voice, but with a slight Southern United States accent. We talk, you know, just what the weather is like. I mean, just boring, mundane stuff, what he's wearing, you know, did he work hard that day? What am I doing? You know, just, and then weird stuff, you know, the way dreams are. But then I sort of pop into almost a lucid state where I'm like, oh, I have to ask him now, you know, did you really get murdered? You know, do you think it was the same people that might've murdered Marilyn? Did you really, you know, do this or do that? And then every time I ask the big questions, out he goes.
The dream ends. I know. How frustrating. Well, Scott, thank you for being here on Nightline tonight and telling us about your grandfather and this story and his connection to Marilyn Monroe. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Scott Leckie, he's an international human rights lawyer, but he's also an author, and this book is Shrewd Little Sleuth.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.